Chapter 3. The next day, the weather was so foul that only Laura had the determination to set off for church. As she was waiting at the stable for Cass to hitch up the horse sidling ill-temperedly, trying to get his tail to the wind, and Cass swearing as he struggled with the harness, her brother appeared. "I'll drive you over," he said. "Don't trouble, Itali." Unheeding, he brought the horse around with a slap, hitched him, gave Laura a hand up. They set off along the lake shore road to San Lorenzo, through the dripping, wind-twisted woods. To the left, between the bare trees, the lake lay grey and flat. "When did you stop going to church?" "I'm going now," he said. The horse plodded on through mud. Branches dripped. Now and then sleet cut and stung in a light shower. "In jail," Laura said. "When you were in jail..." After a little while, he answered. "I couldn't think about much. My mind wouldn't hold. It was always dark. The closest I got to God was mathematics. It wasn't much good. Do you know what worked? Not very often. But the only thing that I ever did, I wouldn't think of God's love. I'd think about the water inside the boathouse in afternoon in summer, when the light comes from underneath. Or the plates. The dinner plates. The ones we used last night. If I could see them, I was all right. So much for the things of the Spirit." "Except the Lord build the house," Laura said, almost in a whisper, but with a smile. He did not know what she meant. Though it had been a relief to speak of St. Lazare, it had been a great effort also, and he drove on in silence. Several people of the Valtorsa household had come to St. Anthony's, Piera, Becca Gavre, Maria, and a couple of maids, Godin, the coachman. The little chapel was bitter cold, full to the roof, with cold grey light. Itali sat, stood, knelt with the rest of them through the mass. Only when Father Clement began, "Credo in unum Deum," he wanted to laugh, but with sudden pleasure. He saw what Laura meant. He saw why she'd been able to say to him, "You are my freedom," knowing what he had not known, that she was his freedom, that you cannot leave home unless there is a home to leave. Who builds the house? And for whom is it built? For whom kept? Father Clement, as usual, wanted to speak to Laura after the service. Itali waited for her in the porch of the chapel. Old Maria and the Valtorsa maids were there, waiting for Godin and Gavre to bring the buckboard around. Piera came out, retying her kerchief. She glanced at Itali, said hello in her polite way, and went on down the steps into the wind and rain. But there was nowhere to go. She stood down at the churchyard gate at the edge of a sea of mud, small and erect, her back turned. He followed her. "Why don't you wait in the porch?" She did not answer or turn round. "Go back out of the rain. I'll stay down here," he said softly, half teasing. She looked up at him with her clear eyes. She was in tears, or the wind had made her eyes water. "If you like," she said, and went back up the steps. Gavre drove up. The Valtorsa people climbed into the buckboard and rolled off under the pines. He turned back and stood with his hands on the gate, looking out at the lake and the dark mountains on the other side. The wind was in his eyes. A sky of grey clouds ran overhead, ceaseless in rapid, silent tumult. he remembered the sky over the courtyard of St. Lazare. So the clouds had run there all winter long, 3 winters long, indifferent, unattainable, beautiful. There was nothing to keep. Life ran like the clouds. One voyaged and the other stayed, yet they met on their way. And in their meeting was all the goal of voyaging and all the substance of fidelity, the shape and motion of a cloud. A few yards from him, across the gate of the churchyard, lay the grave marked with his grandfather's name, his name. He thought of the moment last night, the earliest and most terrible memory roused when his father had said, "You're here too, Itali." But it was no longer terrible. "I'm here," he said, into the wind. His sister was out in the chapel porch now, and he went round to bring up the trap. As they drove back, the wind was weaker, and a fine, wintry, drifting rain whispered on the road and passed in dim masses over the forest and the lake. The mountains were full of sound of the rain. The winter was endlessly wet, but there was not much snow, and spring came early. By mid-March, when the north wind cleared the sky, the forest rippled paler green, showing new growth at the tips of the dark branches. And the same light, clear green broke in the waves of the lake on windy mornings. Since it rained hard on the morning of the equinox, Laura and Itali put off the trip they had planned to Evalde until the next fair day. It rained almost daily, well into April. And by that time Laura, without consulting her brother, had invited everybody else to come along. And San Giusto and the Valtoscas had accepted. Itali was annoyed. He'd anticipated the trip as he had in his boyhood, a solitary course at dawn in the little boat, the ceremony with which spring began. He had thought Laura understood that and felt the same way. This would be a mere pleasure trip, a picnic over at the caverns. Meaningless. And there would be all the constraint of being in Piera's company. Ever since he had seen her drive off under the pines of San Lorenzo that winter day, he had felt he must speak to her, but he was not certain, when it came to the point, what he wanted to say. And in any case, he was unable to, since she was unwilling to say anything to him at all. Falcone could not carry 5, and they were planning to go in Mazeppa. That was the last straw. He would not sail across in that cow of a boat. He wanted his own boat under his own hand. And he said, autocratic, "I want to take Falcone." So there he was, on a morning of early April, his boat skimming over the water, a quarter of a mile ahead of the other, with Piera sitting in the stern to steer. They went a mile before anything was said, except Itali's orders concerning steering, as he tried to catch the fresh, fitful wind. At last, they were sailing steadily, the house on its peninsula grown small behind them, under the great slope of San Givan. The sound of the cascade came faint and clear over the water in the silence of the mid-lake. Piera sat with her hand on the tiller, her dark head turned away from him. "I wish there were more wind," she said, "and we could sail clear to Chiasa Fonte." "Takes a good wind and all day," Itali said. She watched him as he stood up, coatless, long-legged, to recoil a rope from the gearbox. The sunlight of April poured down on his head, his back, his hands, the lake beyond him, the mountains above the lake. The wind blew his brown hair, grown out long again, across his eyes. He brushed it away with a gesture she remembered. "Has anybody ever sailed down the Chiasa?" Pierre Sorrente took a rowboat down once on a dare. Broke up on a rock just past the village. Hoy, hoy there. There's Papa dancing about. Shall we turn? No, said Pierre. They went on. The hails from Mazeppa ceased. I don't suppose they're sinking, Pierre said doubtfully, looking back. No. Envious, said Itali, whose heart was growing lighter as they sailed on through the wind and sun. But their wind was beginning to fail them, and the lake lay glassy. Are we going to have to row? Probably when we come under the lee of the Hunter. It's so still, like sailing in air. Their wind lasted until they entered the Gulf of Vivaldi, in the shadow of the overhanging mountain. There, the air was hot and still in the fire of noon, the clear brown water utterly motionless. Itali rowed. Before them loomed the dark cliffs and basalt columns of the shore. They heard, but could not see the cascade, hidden from them by the cleft it had cut itself in the jutting cliffs. Like rowing in oil, he said, whispering, in the strange hush of the gulf that had no sound in it but the dull vibration of the river plunging to the lake. They came to the landing place, a gravel beach a few yards long, to the right of the Hermit's Rock. Itali raised the oars and got his breath a minute before landing the boat. Winded, he said, with reference to the general direction of Piera. She did not say anything, but took the little dipper from under the stern seat, dipped it up full of the transparent lake water, and offered it to him. He took it from her and drank. He ran the boat up on the beach with one great push of the oars and a flying leap, when it touched gravel, to pull it up so that Piera could step out dry-shod. His timing was perfect, elegant, and he was smiling with pleasure as he handed Piera out of the boat. Mazeppa was just at the entrance of the gulf, a black blot on the bright water. Are they rowing yet? Far-sighted like Guide, he looked and said, Yes. No lunch for a while, then. The cascade thundered across the water, muted, tremendous. Let's go up to the top of the falls. A path of sorts wound up past the Hermit's Rock to the top of the cliffs. Piera set off at once, very quick in her dark red skirt, unhesitating even when the way was nothing but a jump from one boulder to another, or when the black, broken rock of the cliffside slid and rattled underfoot. Long after her, Itali came out at the top of the climb, in open sunlight, at the head of the falls, where the river escaped from the cavern to plunge down its vertical cleft to the lake. They watched it till they were dizzy and deafened, and still went on watching it. At last, they went to sit on the stone-broken grass under a low, wall-like cliff, the outer wall of the caverns. The dark rock was full of vibration like distant thunder, the roar of the imprisoned river. Will they know we're up here? Laura will bring them. We always came up here. Piera got up again, trying to see the other boat through the pines below the clearing. The sunlit air was warm about them. Restless, nervous, she wandered down the wild slope among the rocks near the edge of the falls. Piera. Yes. What is this? She came over slowly, listening for the voices of their people through the dull roar of the river. Itali held out to her a spray of small rock plant. She took it and sat down with a small sigh. I don't know. It's pretty, like a fern with flowers. It only grows here. Piera sat twirling the flowered spray, gazing at the contorted rocks, the pines that grew tall among them, the bright lake out beyond the gulf. The sun, straight overhead in the dark blue sky, poured down heat and light till the clearing brimmed like a cup. Piera, I need to ask you, is Laura in love? Of course, she said, without turning. Francesco spoke to me last night. He said if I decided he should not, he won't speak to Father. I don't know what I should do. She was watching him now, not with the reproach or irony it feared. Of course, it's up to Laura. But it would upset Father badly. Not without reason. Francesco is a homeless man, dependent on his sister sending him enough to live on. Austria will hound him all his life, I suppose. He could go to France or England. But what would Laura do there? She never wanted to leave Malafrena. I brought him here. It's my responsibility. I don't know what to say. Why shouldn't she leave Malafrena? It was me that wanted to stay. She's always wanted to go, to see things. Where he is would be her home. Itari was silent for a bit. He can't leave now. They'll arrest him at the border. Perhaps not with a wife and false name, Piera suggested mildly, but startling Itali. You and Laura have talked about this? Not about that. We haven't really ever said much at all about that. I know she loves him. Why can't they stay here? As long as they want to, I mean. Nobody's using the old dower house. I thought of having fitted up. He certainly is a very useful man on the farm. Yes, he is, Itali said, bemused. You could take him into partnership. Into partnership? Then if one of you wanted to go back down there, there would be one of you running the estate. Yes. And since no one is using the dower house, they can live there. I'd like to have it looked after. Wait a minute, he said. Then presently, it all seems practicable. You must have thought about this a good deal. Of course I have. Her voice trembled as she spoke. He looked at her again intently, wonderingly. His face was grave and still. There was something I wanted to say to you, too, she said. Her voice, over-controlled, sounded thin. He nodded, acceptant. She paused for a long time. There are so many reasons, habit, and the land adjoining at so many places, and so on. And I suppose they talked about it when we were children. People always do. I'm sorry I was unpleasant to you that night last winter. That was stupid. I was just trying to say what I want to say now, that people will think we are likely to get married, but they're mistaken, and that keeps us from being friends. The small, strained voice trembled continually, like the trembling of water, but remained clear. I should like to be your friend. You are, he said, almost inaudibly. But his heart said, you are my house, my home, the journey and the journey's end, my care and sleep after care. All right, she said, this time with a great sigh. And they were silent for a while, there on the grass, in the great heat and light of noon. You will go back down there some day, won't you? When I can. Good, she said, and smiled suddenly, I wasn't sure. Then you will keep the Vita Nova. I said I was sorry, she said angrily. Up this way, Count Orlant, called Laura's voice down among the pines. You have to keep it, he said with intensity. I didn't know why I left till I came back. I've come back to find that I have to go again. I haven't even begun the new life yet. I'm always beginning it. I will die beginning it. Will you keep it for me, Pierre? Ah, there you are, San Giusto proclaimed from the top of the path. Pierre looked at Itali directly for one instant, then scrambled to her feet and went to greet the others. Well, 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 said Count Orlant, surmounting the last steps of the way heavily. Oh, what a pull. Hello, daughter. Did you have a row? You took so long. Indeed we did. Laura and I pulled two strokes to Mr. San Giusto's one, and still we went in circles. I thought you two would be keeping cool in the cavern, said Laura. It's as hot as summer here. Have an apple. Your face is purple, said San Giusto, proffering the hamper. What a lovely thing of you to say. Yes, I will. Do you want lunch now? Yes, Itali said. All of it. No, I want to see the caverns, San Giusto announced, stretching his strong arms and looking about him blissfully. Then, give me an apple, fratello mio. Stay him with flagons, Count Orlant said. Comfort him with apples. Are you all going, then? Won't you come, Count? No, I want to sit down right here. Caverns and torrents and all that are for the young. Leave me with the lunch. Go on. You don't think I'll eat it all? All right. We'll be back in half an hour. Wear your hat if you're sitting out in the sun, Papa. Leave us some bones and peelings, Count. Go on. Go on. And that is the end of Malafrena by Ursula K. Le Guin.